Never starts with one of the guys on the corner. It's always some strange 13-year-old that says, you know what? You know anything about Spanish Fly? No, tell me about it. Well, there's this girl, Crazy Mary. You put some in her drink, man. She, yeah, Spanish, oh, yeah, that's really groovy, man.
Slipping drugs into women's drinks. There's some creepy foreshadowing. This week, more women came forward accusing comedian Cosby of that very technique for rape. Allegations such as have been accumulating for years. The charges were certainly in circulation back in 2008 when writer Ta-Nehisi Coates covered Cosby in a freelance piece for The Atlantic. But Coates' subject back then was a different matter concerning Cosby's so-called call-out tour, in which the iconic performer scolded black audiences for self-destructiveness and moral laxity in their communities. The story, which challenged Cosby's assumptions, changed the trajectory of Coates' career. He was unemployed and flat broke at the time. Now he is national correspondent for The Atlantic. But this week, he wrote an essay of introspection verging on self-flagellation, because as the picture emerges of Cosby as a serial predator, Coates realizes he deliberately downplayed the predations back in 2008. Ta-Nehisi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let me begin, at least, by offering you some exculpatory material. The piece you wrote in 2008 was about Cosby's call-out tour. It was not meant to be a general profile, right?
That's exactly right. It wasn't a profile. And that's very interesting you said, because that was the argument made to me at the time by people, you know, around me, very, very close to me. You know what I'm saying? Even be outside of our editorial at The Atlantic, about whether to go forward and how it should be written. And it was an internal argument that I had with myself. Yep.
So you plan a hunting trip to go hunting for deer. You come across a dead body, you don't say, well, I'm really here to deer hunt, so I'm going to ignore this corpse sitting here in the leaves. Did you ignore the corpse in the leaves?
More what I did was I nodded at the corpse in the leaves. I pointed out, hey, you know, somebody should really do something about that corpse, and kept hunting. That's more like what I did. Because it's in the piece, right? I mean, the problem is not that it's ignored. The problem is that it's sort of, you know, said in a very limp and weak way. Hey, there's a dead body here. Somebody should really look into that. In my world, in my mind, I was writing one Bill Cosby story. And I wasn't, as you say, writing a profile of Bill Cosby. Surely other reporters were going to follow up. Surely there would be other reporting about Bill Cosby. It would not, you know, just be me. I don't know. I was in the world of my story. It was my story. That was the story I was writing. That was the story I was doing.
Well, if you have any culpability as a journalist, probably we all have culpability as the audience do, because I don't think anybody was dying to see Dr. Huxtable trotted out
that's the problem, right there. See, that is exactly the problem. I had none of those illusions. Like, I think other people had to do psychological work to imagine Bill Cosby. I had none of that. That's not what got in my way. Like, I pride myself, like, even in that piece, I thought, you know, hey, man, here's a skeptical, counterintuitive take. This is not what, you know, people are saying about Bill Cosby right now. I'm doing something, you know, different than whatever else you're going to see. It wasn't different enough, though. You know what I mean? Like, it should have been, if anything, like, the lesson for me is you have these instincts, because I did have instincts at the time, go harder. Or always go harder. Always go harder.
Yes, it would have taken you off the story you had pitched and were assigned. And yes, it would have required a whole lot more legwork as you go back and do your due diligence on accusations and
No, Bob. It would have required me, for instance, to figure out, well, how I was going to pay the next month's rent. Mm. I mean, that's I'm being real with you. I'm not, you know, that again, that doesn't excuse it. Like, that's the work you signed up for. But it's also the work. You know, it also is the work.
Now, you're black. And you are more than well acquainted with the narrative of black sexual predators that have ended in countless lynchings and probably goes to the core of the worst pathologies of racism. The idea that black men would defile white women. And a lot of these victims are white. And even as Bill Cosby was going on the stump, wagging his scolding finger at black Americans, he was feeding the core of so much racism in this country. Emmett Till is hanging from a tree limb for looking sideways at the wrong woman, and Bill Cosby is allegedly slipping Mickeys in women's drinks. Huh.
That's not even a connection I had made, but I think you're exactly right. I mean, what, he became every white racist, you know, fever dream. If anything, you know, that called for, you know, even more so for it to be investigated. That's a connection I hadn't even made.
Even now, this is still allegations, and there's no physical evidence. There are no rape kits. There are no eyewitnesses. You know, I suppose there's always the possibility of some sort of hysteria going on. But that's quite a leap, is it not?
It's a big leap. If you think about all of the possibilities, you know, things that people throw out, well, he's rich and he's famous and people make allegations and he's a target. Oh, yeah, well, why aren't there 18 women accusing Barack Obama? Why aren't there 18 women accusing Denzel Washington? There's a lot of rich, famous black people out there.
So you've done this kind of stunning mea culpa. Are you going to stay on the story? I mean, you're certainly not on the Bill Cosby beat. But is there anything you're going to do on the Cosby story to go hard now?
I don't know. I wrote that post, but it's not a conclusion. This is happening in real time. You know, the accusations are coming fast and furious right now. I think we're up to 18, you know, women. And the thing I think about is for every woman who comes out publicly, how many women are there, you know, who for very, very understandable reasons are not coming out publicly? And for every woman who's not coming out publicly, how many women are there who did not end up back at the hotel, did not end up drugged, who thought Cosby was creepy to begin with? You know, there's so many stories that must be out there. So, possibly so.
Ta-Nehisi, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. Coming up, when you're stuck in the middle of a news story and the media get to decide who you are. This is On the Media.
Thanks for the memory.
That's Bob Hope in 1938, singing for the first time the song that would become his signature. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with his biographer, Richard Zoglin. Zoglin argues that Hope was the most popular entertainer of the 20th century. Join us.
For the memory.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
The Parthenon and moments.
If you're already an annual supporter of WILL, why not shift your gift to our sustainer option? Shifting your valued support to continuous monthly giving has a powerful impact on our station. When we know we can count on your support each month, we become a stronger community resource. It's an affordable, convenient way to support the programs you love. So, still have questions? Call us 1-800-898-1065 or go to willpledge.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Soon after Dr. Craig Spencer returned from West Africa infected with Ebola from treating patients there, he was a household name.
Good evening, I'm Jim Rosenfield. That doctor's name is Craig Spencer.
The patient is Craig Spencer, this man. He's a doctor who recently returned to the
U.S. For every one Craig Spencer, we need 100 Craig Spencers to get over there. That's how we're going to solve this problem.
Not quite the same for nurses who became infected. They were more like a household generic.
Ebola nurse, her message to America.
The vow not to put the Ebola nurse's little dog to sleep.
An odd, if not exactly surprising, double standard. But one mere female healthcare worker is having none of it. She is Casey Hickox, the nurse who was subjected to involuntary quarantine imposed by two governors against expert medical advice until she was sprung by a judge who'd read the Constitution. Hickox isn't willing to lose her freedom of movement and her identity in the same month.
Nurse Casey Hickox has been dubbed the so-called Ebola nurse, and why she doesn't want that nickname anymore.
Yes, she chafed at being reduced to an anonymous bit player in a fear-fueled melodrama, but now she's fed up with the ongoing stigma. In a Guardian essay this week, Hickox wrote, quote, "I never had Ebola. I never had symptoms of Ebola. I tested negative for Ebola the first night I stayed in New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's private prison in Newark. I am now past the incubation period, meaning that I will not develop symptoms of Ebola. I never had Ebola, so please stop calling me the Ebola nurse now." Thing is, there is no such thing as headline due process and no media judge to save the day. Indeed, in this segment, we explore many examples of news subjects, especially women, whose identities are co-opted and defined and even hijacked by media narratives entirely beyond their ability to influence. Our coverage begins with a story revisited this week in the New York Times online documentary series Retro Report, The Strange, Tragic Case of Lindy Chamberlain. In 1982, Chamberlain was convicted in an Australian court of murdering her 9-week-old infant daughter, Azaria, who had vanished on a family camping trip in the outback. Chamberlain claimed the baby had been snatched from the tent by an indigenous wild dog called a dingo. The episode scandalized a nation, but also came to enthrall the world, and to this day persists in the popular imagination thanks to one unexpected exclamation.
The dingo's got my baby!
That's Meryl Streep as Chamberlain from the 1988 film A Cry in the Dark. The latest Retro Report examines Chamberlain's trial, conviction, and eventual exoneration stretched over 30 years and the media circus that surrounded it. Jennifer Ford directed and produced the Retro Report. She says that doubts about Chamberlain's story began with a sort of dingo jingoism, a romantic Aussie notion of the native animal's sunny disposition.
Everybody in Australia at that time believed it to be a wild dog, but basically timid. So whilst initially everybody local believed her story, when outsiders started to come in, police and journalists, people started to suspect the parents and indeed Lindy for having murdered her baby.
This was a case, as it turned out, of jaw-dropping incompetence by police and forensics experts and by the media, which became a sort of whole nation full of Nancy Graces looking for reasons to convict Lindy Chamberlain in the press. And she kind of helped in a way because her demeanor was so strange, was it not?
I think that was one of the things that was confusing to people, that she was dealing with her anguish. She didn't break down in public. She was able to speak very rationally about it. And she did this one interview in particular, which really turned people.
Were you surprised Azaria's clothing was found hardly torn?
No, not really. Not having watched wild dingoes feed on cattle and things like that.
They pull back the skin as they go, and they'll just peel it like an orange.
Whilst that's true, I think people just found it very surprising that she would be able to sort of answer so clinically. But really, she's just answering the question.
It was as if she had sat on the witness stand confessing, as far as the public was concerned.
Right. And then during the trial, it must have been very difficult to be there on the stand listening to these ridiculous scenarios. She was sort of short-tempered with the prosecution, which didn't come across well to the jury.
Concerning the accusation at the time of the trial that she was just too unemotional, she told you in the film that she was between a rock and a hard place.
If I smiled, I was belittling my daughter's death. If I cried, I was acting. The point is, until you go through something, you have no idea how you yourself will react.
Ultimately, she is on trial for her personality. Immediately after it had happened, when the press came in, I think Lindy wanted to share her experience with people and make other people aware of the dangers. Instantly there was a backlash and people couldn't understand why she wasn't openly breaking down in front of the cameras. Her lawyers apparently suggested to her before she went to trial that she didn't show emotion. She said to us she felt like that was bad advice. And indeed, there are several accounts of how she did break down in court, but they just went unreported.
The prosecution shows up with no body, very little physical evidence, and no murder weapon, and she was convicted and sent to prison.
Well, Lindy had always maintained that her baby had been wearing a little jacket over the jumpsuit that was initially found in the search immediately after her baby's disappearance. But they never found this jacket, and very quickly people decided that she had invented the jacket. No dingo saliva or hairs were found on the jumpsuit. So she had said, well, because she was wearing a jacket, the evidence of the dingo would be on the jacket. And when no one found the jacket, people said, oh, well, look, you've just made up the jacket.
Then what happened?
3.5 years after she'd been incarcerated, some searchers were out looking for the body of a climber who had fallen to his death. They found the jacket, and less than a week later, Lindy was let out of prison.
Her nightmare did not end there. In fact, it's only very recently that the coroner report attributed Azaria's death to a dingo attack. Bizarrely, one of the reasons that she has not been able to escape the narrative that was built around her was that one line we heard uttered by Meryl Streep. When it came out of Lindy Chamberlain's own mouth, it sounded like this.
It wasn't time to go and tell people. I just yelled out, "Has anyone got a torch? The dingo's got my baby."
For whatever reason, the line actually made Lindy, a woman who had lost her child, an object of ridicule in a way we've seldom seen before. Here's a little montage.
Maybe the dingo ate your baby.
Hey, I think I hear a dingo eating your baby.
Dingo ate my baby.
A dingo ate my baby.
The dingo took my baby. It mutated into a dingo ate my baby. Is to this day a global punchline. Why did that happen, do you suppose? And what effect has it had on the travails of Lindy Chamberlain?
I mean, that was one of the big questions that we had coming into the story. Maybe that the word dingo was a funny word to the American ears. It sounded like some sort of strange mythical creature. There was another suggestion that perhaps the ridicule was more about Meryl Streep, that at the time she was taking quite a lot of parts and she was doing funny accents. So it may have been that Meryl was the figure of fun more than Lindy. But nevertheless, it's just amazing that it captured the public imagination. Lots of people today, I think, don't really know that it is a true story.
She was characterized as a kind of femme fatale, as a religious cultist. She and her husband were Seventh-day Adventists, a fairly exotic religion in Australia. And this narrative, some of it persists in Australia to this day. People still think she did it.
What the prosecution managed to do was concoct a gripping story, and Lindy's public demeanor lent itself very well to the key villain. And the defense had a hard time countering that. I think the fact that she was a woman is really key. I don't think it would have played out in quite the same way if her husband had been the one who was accused. When I was doing my research, I spoke to a Reuters journalist who covered this case and subsequently went on to cover the Amanda Knox trial in Italy. And he said that there were great similarities, that there was a really fine line between being good-looking and being too good-looking. They were sort of sexy women, and people just didn't trust them. They were almost too attractive for the case.
Jennifer, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jennifer Ford is a producer for Retro Report. She directed and produced the documentary about Lindy Chamberlain, which you can find on nytimes.com. There are many ways to lose control of your own media narrative, and one such is to have your story twisted by a self-interested third party. Or, worse still, to have your story twisted by two self-interested third parties when the stakes are life or death for countless innocents. Consider Rihanna, an attractive former law student who took up arms on behalf of the Kurdish militia battling ISIS. The Rihanna story turns out to be, for some news outlets, too good to check. Craig Silverman of the rumor-tracking website Emergent wrote a piece about Rihanna this week. Craig, welcome back.
Thank you.
This strange tale begins, as so many do, with a Swedish photographer? Tell me.
Apparently it does. In late August, a Swedish journalist named Carl Drott is in Kobane, and he watches the creation of a new unit, a home unit, as they're called. And these are Kurdish fighters who are going to support the fighters at the front, the local police in that particular town. And one of the people there is this woman, and he takes a photo of her, and he talks to her, but he doesn't get her name. And he ends up mentioning her and quoting her in an article he did for Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper. And that sort of leaves it there for a little while, until about the middle of October, when a journalist/activist tweets a photo of her claiming that her name is Rihanna, and she's killed 100 Islamic State fighters.
Which is quite a feat for somebody who's really on the home guard, presumably not really encountering much in the way of battle. nonetheless, I'm sitting here looking at an International Business Times headline from October 14, and it says, heroine of Kobani, Kurdish female fighter Rehana kills 100 ISIS jihadis single-handedly. I'm going to take a wild guess that it begins with her being kind of adorable, a very sweet smile, and she's making the V sign in the original photograph taken by the journalist.
Well, that's one of the interesting pieces of it. We have no idea, as of right now, who took this photo of her. The photo that Carl Drott took is her standing among other fighters, sort of at attention. And then there's this other photo, the one that ends up everywhere, which is her smiling at the camera, showing the V sign, giving a beautiful smile. Nobody knows who took that photo.
So she became a kind of meme in camouflage fatigues. The same story was passed along fairly uncritically by the mainstream press as well. How big a media presence did Rehana have?
One piece of it on social media is that one tweet was retweeted close to 6,000 times. And as it picked up its velocity, of course, there are news outlets who are really watching for what's taking root on social media, and they jump on that. And so International Business Times was one of several news outlets that wrote it up. People like Mail Online, Daily Mirror, a lot of the UK tabloids, as well as some smaller websites. Her image and her legend starts to build. She becomes the face, in a lot of ways, of this resistance.
And as a matter of propaganda value, extremely important to the Kurds, who now have a face of the struggle, which presents a media problem for ISIS.
That's right. So after the tweet goes viral, after the news articles, and frankly, after they see a claim that I'm sure they would find to be incredibly offensive, that a female fighter had killed 100 of their militant colleagues, they decide to fight back. And so all of a sudden, ISIS supporters on Twitter start talking about the fact that they have killed Rehana. And in fact, there's even a photo that starts circulating of a fighter with a big smile on his face holding what appears to be the decapitated head of a woman. The head really doesn't look like Rehana, but that's enough that now suddenly we get the second blossoming of media articles of, oh no, have they killed Rehana?
And as far as you can tell, neither the original narrative nor the counter-narrative has any truth to it whatsoever.
What we know is that this woman really exists. She's definitely a volunteer fighter in the Kurdish forces, which is a very admirable thing. Carl Drott met her, took a photo of her, quoted her. We don't know who took the other photo. Her name is likely not Rehana. Carl Drott says that's not a common name for Kurdish women. Because she's in the Home Guard unit, the chances that she was fighting on the front are relatively slim, and the chances that she, or perhaps any individual Kurdish fighter, could give a verifiable claim to killing 100 Islamic State fighters, most likely, again, not true. And then the claims of having killed her don't really hold water either.
Now, you are Mr. Rumor, and you have isolated kind of three varieties. Where does the Rehana legend fit in?
One of the important rumor studies that was done in the 1940s looked at over 1,000 wartime rumors and found that they fit pretty much nicely into one of three categories. One category being a wish rumor, you know, something that people hoped was true, fear rumors driven by the worst case scenarios that people could imagine. And then the third category were wedge driving rumors aimed at attacking specific people and segments of society. For me, the story of Rehana is a perfect wish rumor out of a war zone, a perfect image, a lovely smile, and a really amazing claim that plays into the wishes that I think most of us in the West have in terms of what's going to happen to Islamic State, that they'll be not only taken down and killed, but in fact in a way that goes right against their misogynistic ideology.
If this mythology can so take root, should this give us reason to be suspicious of everything that's coming out of Iraq and Syria?
I think the short answer is yes. There are very few news organizations that have consistent and reliable reports coming from the ground there. We know now that Islamic State is targeting journalists and trying to kill them and kidnap them. And in a lot of cases, news organizations have to start relying on NGOs and other sources to put out information that they can then use in their reporting. And as much as third parties might have good intentions, we don't know how they got their information, and we should be skeptical of all of these things. Absolutely.
Craig, thank you.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman wrote about the Rahana rumors as part of a new collaboration between his website Emergent and Dig. They'll be using social media data to track and dispel media rumors. It's one thing to be thrust by fate into the center of a news event and struggle as your name and personal experiences are bandied about willy-nilly, but what if the news subject is a victim whose name is by law excluded from coverage, rendering her a virtual non-entity? That's what happened to Rataya Parsons, a 15-year-old Canadian victim first of sexual assault, then of cyberbullying, when a digital photo of the assault taken by one of her teenage attackers emerged online. The traumatized teenager eventually took her own life. Now, 3 years later, the perpetrators are finally facing charges, not for sexual assault, but for the manufacture and distribution of child pornography. But because that is the charge, and because she was a minor, a provision of Canadian law blocks any publication of Rataya's name. This incenses her father, Glenn Canning, who believes the justice system failed his daughter by neglecting to prosecute a rape, and now by rendering her a literally anonymous victim. Canning believes the law ostensibly meant to protect his late daughter is instead protecting her tormentors and devaluing her memory. A warning, the details of this story are disturbing. Glenn Canning, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Please tell me where this all began, the party.
Okay. A lot of news reports have said she went to a party, but she didn't. She went to a sleepover at a friend's house that she had recently met in Cole Harbour High. She just started grade 10, and the friend knew a couple boys who lived close by and suggested they should go over and see them, so they did, and the boys happened to have some alcohol. Rataya remembers having a few drinks of vodka, and then she doesn't remember very much at all until the next morning.
And there was no inkling that she'd been assaulted until the photos emerged?
No, what happened was she knew that when she woke up the next day that something was wrong. She knew because she can tell by her body, by sore points. She had bruises on her ankles and on her wrists. On the Monday, the boys showed up, all four of them basically showed up at school with this story that Rataya Parsons was a slut, that she had slept with all of them, and she pretty much fled the school right then and there. One of them took a photograph of her being assaulted, where she was hanging out a window, vomiting, while one of the males was pressed into her behind, looking at the camera, smiling, giving a thumbs up. Mm. And once the photo left the cell phone, it pretty much went viral.
Mm. The insult added to the injury was cyberbullying and her reputation just being dragged through the mud.
Yeah, there was girls that she had known since she was 5 years old. The friend she'd had for her whole life instantly turned on her and threatened to beat her up, threatened to kill her. You know, they believed the story that she was a slut, and they tormented her. And Rataya tried for the next year and a half to reclaim her life, and she would always end up having to have that photo shown in her face. You know, is this you? You're that girl hanging out the window throwing up. The last time she tried high school was a whole year later, a whole new community, a whole new group of friends and everything like that. And she texted me 2 weeks after starting school, "Dad, I want to come home." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "There's people here saying stuff about me that's not true." It followed her, and she just didn't have a chance. She didn't have a chance at all to get her life back together.
And eventually, she committed suicide.
And it came right out of the blue. I drove her home the night before from a sexual assault counselor session that she had. When she said that she had a good talk, she would tell me about setting resumes up, and she seemed fine, she seemed happy. You know, she met a good guy that was taking care of her and really thought a lot about her. And the next day, right out of the blue, you know, I had a phone call from her mom saying that I need to get to the hospital right away and that she had hung herself. They can't find any brain activity.
There was no prosecution of the boys for rape, am I correct?
Yeah, you're correct. In the original investigation, they looked at this file and they said there's no evidence here that we can prove anything in court. So they didn't go ahead with any charges. But as soon as they opened up the file again after she died, they laid these child porn charges.
So after Rataya's death, the police believed that they needed to do something and the charge was child pornography. What has taken place in the intervening time?
The child porn case, the first one, has concluded. The male who was involved with that pled guilty. He was sentenced last week. The other one is going to be tried on Monday, and we have reason to believe that he's going to plead guilty to it as well. Nothing else. There's been no investigation at all into the sexual assault aspect of this, even though in the courtroom they admit that in the photograph it shows Rehtaeh hanging out a window vomiting from intoxication while someone is having sex with her.
The media of Canada may not print your daughter's name ostensibly to protect her.
Right.
Is there any community in the province of Nova Scotia where her name and this episode are not known to all?
There's not a community at all that doesn't know the name of Rehtaeh Parsons. Her name last week, after there was a sentencing for the production of child pornography, a hashtag trended in Canada, you know her name. That's the hashtag. And after that, what was second trending was Rehtaeh Parsons. Everyone knows who she is. Everyone knows what's going on. And to me, it almost seems like, okay, the justice system wants to shut the story down. I believe in my heart the Canadian public is saying, no, you're not going to shut this down. You're not going to erase her name. We're not going to allow that to happen. And it comes to a point now where the justice system, whatever they do, they just make themselves look even more ridiculous than they already have before. And good. I'm glad that they do, because they deserve that.
And you are in the heartbreaking position of wanting Rehtaeh's story told.
Yes.
Has none of the coverage in any of the papers identified her on the subject of the pornographic photo?
No. Some of the media in Canada have tried to skirt around the issue by associating her name with cyberbullying. But when the child porn and the rape and the sexual assault comes up, you know, they are just avoided like the plague. What happened was these charges were being brought forward in the courtroom, and all of a sudden the judges said, oh, by the way, it's the law in Canada. You can't name child pornography victims. And I literally watched her name disappear off the Internet in Canada. I could go to websites, and I'm looking, wait, these articles were here about her, and they're gone. It was just unbelievably frustrating that they did something like this. It was like, you know, when she was alive, you didn't do anything. Now that she's dead, a year after she's dead, all of a sudden you're going to enforce the law? Who's this ban protecting? It's protecting a system that really, really needs to be exposed.
Now, you yourself have found yourself at cross purposes with the law. Tell me about that.
I've never stopped using my daughter's name. I never will. So I violated this publication ban every chance I get. And it's been frustrating because I do a lot of talking in high schools about cyberbullying and what happened to my daughter, and I have no hesitation at all to use her name. But the media, for some reason, will shy away from actually covering that, even though it's a very important conversation to have. But I've been reported to the police. Another journalist in Canada, Ryan Van Horn, has violated the ban because he believes it is in the public interest to do so. And the police have announced recently that they're not going to charge any of us. So rather than say, you know, the ban makes no sense, what they're doing really is saying, we won't charge anyone with it, but we will going ahead. But I'm very hurt by it because I know my daughter. I know her in her heart. She would be outraged by this ban. This ban is almost trying to erase her name from a story that could bring a lot of positive change in Canada. It's like they're just trying to erase it and shut the conversation down. I'll never rest allowing that to happen. There's no way.
Glenn, I thank you.
Absolutely. I thank you so much for letting me speak about my daughter. Rehtaeh deserved to be a part of this story, and I want her name to go down in history as a part of this story.
Glenn Canning is the father of Rehtaeh Parsons and an advocate for victims of sexual assault and cyberbullying. TV, movies, radio, Facebook, the Broadway stage, pick a medium and, oh my, George Takei has conquered it. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Road Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. And Staples, offering laptops, tablets, and e-readers. Open extended hours Friday the 28th. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. This is NPR.
Your days are busy.
Work, school, errands, kids.
It never stops.
And the news never stops either.
You can keep up between Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Here and Now. Hi, it's Robin Young.
And Jeremy Hobson. Here and Now brings you breaking news, developing stories, the latest in the arts and innovation.
Asking tough questions, unpacking complex issues.
From across the country and around the world.
Join us.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a Go Green catalog with a variety of items, organic, recycled, or biodegradable, like pet accessories, travel mugs, and water bottles. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Thursday, for a group of marketing executives hosted in New York by the software firm Adobe, I sat down with Star Trek icon turned multimedia phenomenon George Takei. Here's a sampling, edited by Brooke.
Thank you very much, Anne. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My partner in conversation today was a young character actor in 1966, when he was cast for a role that would make him instantly pretty obscure, actually. Star Trek is such an enduring worldwide phenomenon that we forget how it struggled as a first-run series, but it enjoyed a cult following that has grown and grown, and with it the fame of steady at the helm, Mr. Sulu. When the series was canceled, the plucky third officer might have been consigned to being famous for being famous. But what happened to his career and continues to happen is a phenomenon as well. He's an actor. He's been in appointed and elective politics in Southern California. He's a passionate advocate for gay Americans and especially marital rights. He's at the forefront of a movement to redress the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And of late, he has become a social media darling, with Facebook likes exceeding 8 million. But it seems that people have been mispronouncing his name for at least 50 years. So here's a little mnemonic trick. Oh my, it's George to K. Ladies and gentlemen, George Takei. George, I have turned this first question over and over in my head, and what I've come up with is more of an assertion, and I humbly request your comment.
All right.
Dude, what a bizarre career.
Yes, it's true. When I was a very young actor, I cruised around in a pretty cool vehicle called the Starship Enterprise. We have Trekkies here. Live long and prosper. That gave me some kind of, cachet. Together with that came, I thought, a responsibility, because actually my life story begins with December 7th, 1941, when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and overnight, American citizens of Japanese ancestry were looked at with suspicion and fear, and the hysteria grew and grew, where President Franklin Delano Roosevelt used Executive Order 9066, which ordered all Japanese Americans to be summarily rounded up and put in 10 barbed wire prison camps, simply because we happened to look like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. And I remember the barbed wire fence, the sentry towers with the machine guns pointed at us. I remember the searchlight that followed me when I made the night runs to the latrine from our barrack. But I thought it was kind of nice that they lit the way for me to pee. It became normal for me to go with my father to a mass shower, line up three times a day to eat lousy food in a noisy mess hall, go to school in a black tar paper barrack, begin the day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. That's what made me an activist. I've been an activist in the social justice movement, in political campaigns, marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, was in the peace movement during the Vietnam War, was engaged in the redress movement for Japanese Americans. Concurrently, I was pursuing an acting career, and I was able to parlay whatever microphone or camera that Star Trek offered me to amplify my voice on the issues that I was campaigning for.
You had a bully star pulpit.
a galactic pulpit.
I feel kind of silly now, but I want to ask you some questions about Star Trek. It made you immortal.
Not really. You know, we had seven regular characters, and I was like the fourth banana.
Hey, live long and prosper over there. Is he or is he not immortal?
Did I hear immoral? Well, a little bit of that, too.
Now, as I was saying earlier, people forget that the show really struggled, and it was getting clobbered week after week by, like, Gomer Pyle USMC.
You know what the lowest rated episode we ever had was? Where Captain Kirk kissed Uhura, a white man kissing an African-American woman. All the stations in the American South, in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, refused to air it. And so our ratings plummeted. It was because Star Trek was using science fiction as a metaphor for contemporary issues of the time. And those people that became Star Trek fans watched to see what was the subtext of each episode.
The crew of the Enterprise included a black woman, Uhura, a Russian, Chekhov, a Scotsman, Spock, who I think was a twofer, both Vulcan and Asperger's, and one closeted gay Japanese-American.
That was a hidden special.
Was Gene Roddenberry a multicultural visionary or an intergalactic tokenist? What was he up to?
I think he was both. But he was extraordinary in that he was both. Because as you say, you know, at that time, what they had on television was Gomer Pyle and I Love Lucy, which I love too, but they were pure entertainment. Gene Roddenberry felt that television was being wasted, that it had the potential for enlightenment and even inspiration.
One of your key areas is marital rights. You came out in 2007, right?
2005. In 2005, both houses of the California State Legislature passed the Marriage Equality Bill. However, at that time, our governor was a movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger. He ran by saying, "I'm from Hollywood, I've worked with gays and lesbians, some of my best friends are." And I must say, a couple of my gay friends did vote for him because of that statement. But his base was the conservative right-wing Republican base. And so when the bill came to his desk, he vetoed it. That got me so angry, you know, my blood was boiling, that I felt I needed to speak out. And for me to speak out, my voice needed to be authentic. And so I spoke to the press for the first time as a gay man.
After Arnold Schwarzenegger decided to...
Renegger, yes. Yeah.
You were 68 when you came out.
Mm-hmm. I could not have had a career if I were out. No producer would hire you. So I was closeted for most of my life. I was out to family and very close friends, and my Star Trek colleagues knew. At the end of the week, we would have our wrap parties, and the beer would be rolled out, and the pizza would be brought in, and people would bring their wives or husbands or boyfriends or girlfriends with them, and I frequently had buddies with me. And so, you know, my colleagues are hip. They said, "Oh, George, I get it, you know." But they also know that if they spoke about it, they would damage my career. So, you know, my colleagues knew. But in 2005, when Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed the bill, I had to speak out. and I was mindful of the fact that it would probably have an adverse impact on my career. But as it turned out, it blossomed. And I was being cast in TV episodes as a character named George Takei. And that character was gay. So I was playing gay George Takei.
You played gay George Takei on the Howard Stern Show, and it's been a wonderful platform for you.
Well, after I came out, we got a phone call from Howard Stern's office offering me the job of being their official announcer. You know, here I've been going out on speaking tours to universities and various other corporate gatherings on marriage equality. But I was essentially talking to allies or people who are LGBT, people that are already with us. In the United States, we have a large, broad middle that are decent, fair-minded people that are too busy to really think about issues other than their next paycheck. Those are the people that we want to get to in order to change the social climate. And Howard Stern has that audience. So I said, let's boldly go where I've never been before. But I'm an actor, not a radio announcer. So I agreed to do it a week every 3 months. And I had fun. It's a party, which begins very early in the morning. And I became a hit on the Howard Stern Show. Who knew?
Who knew? Oh, my.
Oh, my, indeed.
Is that where it came from?
When I first met him, and this was long before the invitation to be his announcer, I was doing a play in New York. And when you're doing a play, the publicist gives you a list of promotional missions. And that particular morning, I had this address on Madison Avenue. I went there, leafing through some magazines, and they had this radio show on. I said to the guy sitting next to me, why can't they get some nice music? That discussion on the air is disgusting. And he said, that's the show we're waiting to go on. I thought, good Lord. And then that's when they came and got me. I walked in, and here's this skinny guy with wild hair. And I said, good morning to him. And he said, oh, you have a deep voice. Anyone with a voice that deep has to have a big dong. I said, are we on the air? And he said, yes. And I said, oh, my. And he had that on tape. And so from that point on, when someone says or does something outrageous, he presses that button, and my voice, oh, my, comes on. And now he's made it my signature.
I don't remember the last time anyone had a catchphrase. Fred Flintstone, Yabba Dabba Doo. Jimmy Walker, Dynamite, and then nothing until, oh, my.
Jimmy Durante, good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.
Wow, you have just dated yourself.
I'm 77 and proud of it.
I want to come back to those 4 years in the internment camp, mostly in Arkansas, and then I guess later back on the West Coast. Obviously, when you're taking the Pledge of Allegiance to the country that is put you behind barbed wire, even a little child understands the bitter irony of that. Now, 70 some years later, you're working on a political level, but you are also working on an artistic level. You have a musical, Allegiance, that is opening on Broadway in the next season. Tell me about Allegiance.
Allegiance is about one Japanese-American family during the time of the internment. When Pearl Harbor was bombed, young Japanese-Americans, like all young Americans, rushed to their recruitment centers to volunteer to serve in the military. That act of patriotism was answered with a slap in the face. And then they imprisoned us. But a year into imprisonment, the government realized that there's a wartime manpower shortage. And so they came down with another cruel and degrading program called the Loyalty Questionnaire. It was a series of questions, but the most intimidating and enraging question was, Will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? The word forswear assumes that we have an inborn, existing, genetic loyalty to the Emperor. So if you answered no, you were answering no to the first part, will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you answered yes, you were then confessing that you had been loyal to the Emperor and were now willing to set that aside and swear your loyalty to the United States. My parents said, I am not going to grovel before this government. They both answered no, which had them categorized as disloyal. And then there's another group who swallowed their pride and answered that question the way the government wanted them to. And the men were put into a segregated, all-Japanese-American unit. The women were put into the WACs. And they were sent to the European battlefields. And they came back to the United States as the most decorated unit of the entire Second World War. And it's this story that we tell in the context of one family in Allegiance. We broke all box office records, in part my social media campaign. I started my social media campaign primarily for Allegiance.
And now you're, you know, the Ashton Kutcher of senior citizens.
This day is an important day for me. I'll never be any younger than I am now.
Ladies and gentlemen, George Takei.
Thank you very much.